Hi, this is Lisa Brown, and welcome to session 3 of the Coach Power Training Program. Tonight's session is going to be epic because I am going to reveal the 3 reasons why most people never develop a true commitment to anything, as well as how to move yourself and anyone you're coaching from just wanting a goal to having a staunch, unwavering 100% commitment to it. Well, this is also the 3rd week of our Emotional Self-Mastery Blueprints, the 3rd and final week for it. And again, we said that the reason we start with emotional self-mastery is to build self-esteem so that we present as a leader, because we said that people respond more to who we are than what we say. Well, here's our agenda tonight. We're going to review weeks 1 and 2. So already we have discovered the 4 giant inner game mistakes that most people make when trying to eliminate fear. You've also been taken through the practice of self-acceptance, which is the only real way to cure fear. We've also uncovered and solved the mystery of these cycles of depression and demotivation and procrastination. We've looked at letting go, touching the heart center, and being able to release and heal traumas from the past. And we've also discovered the 3 techniques for extraordinary coaching. And you've had a chance with your coach buddy trainings to go through those 3 techniques, to try them more than once now. And this week we're going to add to it the advanced techniques for moving someone, as we said, to that staunch, unwavering commitment. And it is a very, very thrilling topic because it is something that we need. We all need motivation. It is the precursor for action. And as we know, when it comes to reaching goals, action is where it's at. Well, we know the format for the training is very simple. It's a 3-step process. You complete this module as an attendee, participant yourselves, so that you know from the inside out how it works and you've experienced that success. You coach another person through it using the mental toughness blueprints, and you receive coaching from me to advance your coaching skills. Well, I'm going to train you now. Turn your eyes on page 3 of our materials, and we're just going to have a quick pop quiz to go back and get a sense of a few things that we've already covered. We said we were going to review week 2. Let's start with this. I'd like you to write down, hopefully you have a blank piece of paper in front of you. If not, please get one. I want you to write down your very best definition of learned helplessness. I'm going to give you 24 seconds. Please go ahead. And time. Now, it wasn't necessary to get super technical in your definition, but hopefully what you had contained in the words that you wrote down is this idea of giving up. This concept that once we develop a conclusion that we cannot succeed or win, that there is nothing we can do either to get this person to respond the way we want, to do what we need him or her to do, or to get ourselves moving. And learned helplessness tends to be an unconscious response to previous failures, so much so that we don't notice we're very imperceptibly moving away from the things that we are very passionate about. You might have used the word pessimism in your definition. If so, that's excellent. And just this idea of slowly backing up and being very passive. Passivity is something that we always look for, and when you're working with another person, you always want to move them towards understanding just how passive they've become in the situation. Now, last day we also touched on this idea of the power of belief, and you had a chance to write down your learned helplessness with the words "I can't" at the beginning of the statement. And if you looked at the "I can't" statement, you were probably pretty shocked to see it on paper, knowing that there's a part of you that believes that you cannot do something. And we looked at evidence for, you know, why this is true or false in our previous experiences. And we noted that we don't believe what we see as much as we see what we believe in this world, and we will selectively edit out evidence and events that do not correspond with our beliefs. And it is a powerful, powerful filter. And when you're working with other people, one of the things that you're becoming very sensitive to and like a detective looking for is what are the beliefs that they are filtering all of their experiences through. And when you see that, it becomes very obvious to you what an amazing impact those beliefs are having. Okay, next pop quiz. I'd like you to write down, what are the four inner game mistakes that we make once we have been infected with learned helplessness, pessimism, and this giving up response? Again, another 24 seconds. You should know them by heart by now. I want you to write them down very quickly. The four inner game mistakes. Please go ahead. And time. Good. Now, you should have written the following four down briefly now. The first one is self-pity. This is the self-protest. You know, I shouldn't have to deal with this problem. This person shouldn't be treating me this way. And there's very much an idea of feeling sorry for oneself. Other people can fail. Other people can get rejected, but not us. We are too nice and too wonderful to have to go through the adversity that the universe is bringing to us at this time. The second one is suppression. This is the idea that we can push a feeling out of our awareness, especially fear, because once we have learned helplessness, we automatically become afraid. But very often, we're not aware of the fear. We haven't consciously touched the fear. We wouldn't say, I'm afraid a lot of the time. Sometimes we would, but very often we're actually just not aware that the fear is even there. The third one, disowning desires. This is the idea that we try to avoid disappointment and our own vulnerability by pretending that we never really wanted the goal that much in the first place. And the fourth one, of course, is this Lone Ranger idea that we pretend that we know what we're doing and that we can solve our problems alone, even though, as Einstein said, we cannot solve a problem at the same level that we were when we created the problem. So even though we may not have evolved enough to solve the problem, we still pretend that we can, and we soldier on alone. I just want to stop for a moment here and ask, Ray, I think you're on the line. I'm just wondering, of the four inner game errors, which one stood out for you personally in this training so far? Which one did you see in yourself?
I'm just trying to get you off speaker here. Just hold on.
Yep.
Kate, sorry, can you repeat that?
Of the four, when you went through them, because you've had a chance now to look at these four with respect to your own personal goal,
right?
Which one stood out? You know, which one did you look at and say, I think I could identify that in myself?
I think it was more the pride one, more than anything.
And that is such a common one. And why did you pick that one? Why did you notice that one, do you think?
I think it was just more of I was trying to just take more responsibility on than I needed to.
Oh, interesting.
Instead of, you know, maybe putting some extra responsibility on the other individuals.
Good. You know, that is such an important point because we're often told that we should be mature and take on responsibility
exactly.
And not blame. But yeah. We can go too far.
Exactly. Yeah.
And not ask for help in the name of being mature. And one of the 16 core human desires is one for independence, the desire to solve problems on our own. And some people have that desire much more strongly than other people. And in today's session, we're going to touch on the idea that all of our goals have to be intrinsically motivating, that is, touching one of our core desires in life. And independence is a very strong one for some people. How would you say that describes you? Would you say that fits, or would you say not so much?
Yeah, I would say that fits, yeah.
Okay, interesting. So if that's one of your core desires, you're going to have to work harder to overcome that instant reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's fair. Knowing the self, knowing the desires will help you the next time you're struggling with a person, realize I don't need to take all of this on. That person can do his or her 50%.
Exactly.
And it's nice to know that. And it can be a wonderful quality, but as you said, it can be taken too far.
For sure.
Good. All right, we're going to move on. And another, all the pop quizzes are at the beginning. I want you to write down the world's most natural formula for curing fear. These are the three practices of mental toughness that we've been teaching. And I'd like you to quickly go ahead now, give you 30 seconds, and write the three of them down. They should come to mind very easily without having to look at your notes. You can look at your notes, but please go ahead. And time. Now, one of the most important things that you'll want to recognize when you look at the three practices of mental toughness that make up this formula is that they are actually the antidote and the direct opposite of the four inner game reactions to learned helplessness. And this is very important because when you're working with somebody else, you won't always explain to them these four inner game reactions directly. You may educate them on them, maybe, if the moment is right and the time is right and it seems appropriate. But there'll be times when you don't, when it's completely unnecessary, because what you'll be doing is helping them move beyond them without necessarily talking about them directly. But it is critical that you grasp that the formula is actually the direct and opposite antidote to these. So self-pity and suppression are the opposite of self-acceptance. Self-acceptance meaning being able to experience your fear just as it is, being able to accept your situation just as it is. Ray, since we were talking to you, I'm going to pick this back up. Why, in your mind, is self-acceptance the opposite of suppression?
Just being able to face and accept your situation is the best, is the biggest thing. So if you're in a certain situation, then you're maybe not recognizing it fully. I think that's a big thing.
Can you give an example?
For an example, I guess for my situation, just taking on extra responsibility that maybe some of my coworkers should be.
Okay.
And just thinking that I need to do them in order to get them done.
Good. And so you hadn't really faced that was unnecessary? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think in some cases, yeah, for sure.
Good, good. So that was sort of an eye-opener. Wow, like this is not, I don't need to be doing this. This
yeah.
may have slipped into it.
Yeah.
But facing how you actually felt about it.
Yes.
How do you feel about it?
I think in dealing with it now, I'm feeling a lot better about it. Like I think I had a little bit in me that figured that, well, I should just deal with it and not make it, you know, maybe other people's responsibility or issues to deal with.
Yes.
So
that is kind of like how we try to tell ourselves to just suck it up.
Exactly.
But how did you really feel about doing their job, Seth?
Well, it was taking away from my responsibilities as a manager, so I was just, I was basically, you know, overworking myself.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you feel about that?
Well, it makes you feel not really, maybe not really, I'm just trying to think of the word, maybe underappreciated,
mm-hmm.
I guess, would be a good description.
Right. Yeah. And so before you really sat and thought through how you felt about the situation and the situation itself, were you aware of that feeling of underappreciation?
No, not really. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, as you said, well, you know, facing and accepting the situation lets me know that I feel underappreciated and that affects me.
Yeah,
it's affecting my energy. It's affecting how excited I am about the job.
Exactly.
How motivated I am about the job. And it's probably affecting how I'm communicating to people as a result.
Yeah.
Good. And so you just explained it very well, the effect of suppression when it comes to having a personal problem or challenge.
Yeah.
That,
and a lot of times you don't even realize you're doing it.
Isn't that the truth?
That's the amazing thing to me, yeah.
It is, and the thing that is really important to understand, especially when you're working with other people, but working with the self is equally important, is that suppression is not a decision. We don't say, well, I'm going to get up in the morning and I'm feeling underappreciative. I'm just going to go ahead and suppress that now. It doesn't work that way. It's automatic. It's and it can be a very good ability of the body and the brain because, you know, for example, when we go through a personal trauma, sometimes we still have to go to work. There are things that still need to happen in many cases. And so it can be an excellent way of allowing us to function. The problem is we take it too far. The problem is we misapply it and use it often. And your point that we're not even aware of it, that is very important. And when you're working with other people, they're not aware of it either. And they're not placing emphasis on it. In fact, this whole idea of hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, we have been so socialized this way that what will happen when you're working with a client or a friend or a family member is they will go out of their way to tell you all the reasons why they should not feel the way they actually feel. So, Ray, what you said to me about, well, I get up and I say, I should really do this. If I'm being responsible and mature, this is something I should do, and I should just suck it up and go to work and, you know, put on a happy face and have a good attitude. People would often say, well, that is a good attitude, you know,
right,
because we've been socialized that way. So people are going to tell you these things when you're coaching them. And you're going to have to stop them gently and say, interesting, because you're going to you'll flag that. You'll immediately feel that that is an inauthentic thing to say. And you'll feel it. You'll know it's inauthentic when the client says that. I'll use the word client for anyone you're dealing with, including people that you're supervising. They will tell you things. Oh, and P.S., the classic phrase that you want to listen for is not a problem. That's not a problem. If anyone ever says to you, that's not a problem, you know it's a problem. It's a huge problem. And people say it every day. So listen for it. And when a client is giving you all these reasons why I shouldn't have this feeling is not legitimate, this feeling is an overreaction, well, maybe sometimes we overreact, right? Maybe one time out of 10 we are overreacting, but 9 times out of 10, you're bang on in how you feel. And that's why we tune in and listen to it. So it's a great example, Ray. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks.
The next one is the practice of commitment. And notice that the tagline for it is honor your desires. And that's the opposite of telling ourselves we don't need something, we don't want something. And of course, the very best example is always with relationships. You know, I don't care what my boss thinks. I'm just going to email him. We don't need to have rapport. Yeah, I'm not that excited about getting up and going to work today, but I don't need to have that trust there. I don't care what he thinks of me. This is a classic way that we talk to ourselves about relationships. We don't need people. We don't need them to approve of us. We don't need them to like us. We don't need to be connected to them. We don't need trust. When the truth is, we are hopelessly dependent on them. Interdependent in the best of ways. I don't mean dependent as in, you know, we're always people-pleasing and looking for approval. I mean, if you want to, for example, lead a team, you need the approval and rapport of the team. And they of you. So it's perfectly okay to recognize that interdependence. And the practice of commitment allows you to say, yeah, I really want that rapport with the boss. I need it to feel jazzed about getting up every day. I mean, if you've ever had any conflict at work with anybody, all you know is that the next day after this conflict, if it's not resolved, you literally don't want to go to work. And it shocks you how much this person is affecting you in a negative way. You may not even have a whole lot of contact with this person, and it does. So in the practice of commitment, we get real about who we are and what we really need and what we really want. And of course, we know that in the practice of commitment, our job is to create hope. Hope is the stuff of champions, and we do that by creating a learning goal, setting a learning goal that's going to allow us to, let's say, get the approval of the boss. How do I need to communicate with him to build the trust back up since that last conflict? What's going to have to happen between us? And maybe I don't know how right now. Maybe I need some coaching. Maybe I need to read a book. You know, maybe I need to talk to a mentor. But you find a method, a strategy that's going to give you new hope. And that's how we create it. And it is the opposite of backing away from those desires. And of course, the third practice is the practice of competence. We may be very pumped up about our goal and our strategy, but we must make sure it's the right one, because proven success principles are going to get us winning and keep us winning. And that's going to allow that mental toughness to continue. So what we do is we make sure we study those principles, and that's why in this training, I'm going to take you through success principles for relationships, success principles for career, for money, and we're going to go through them all, the ones that are, they're evergreen. In time and memoriam, these have always worked. They've been handed down over the ages, and we know that they're absolutely on point. And that way, when you're working with people, you know that when you educate them, the principles that you suggest are going to pay great dividends. Good. Well, we're on page 5 of the materials, and here's where you are. At this point in the training, you should have done the following. The first is face and acknowledge the situation that is making you afraid and creating learned helplessness. Second, you've gone in depth with whatever learned helplessness / pessimism, what you've given up on specifically, and you've identified those four typical reactions that are deepening your learned helplessness. And, you know, Ray volunteered today to say, hey, pride is one that really jumped out at me because I don't ask for help. I don't ask for contribution enough. I take too much responsibility for the problem. That's deepening my learned helplessness, and I tend to get more and more passive, and that's very self-aware. So you should be getting to know yourself with these four typical reactions. You know, which ones are your Achilles heel? Which one gets you? Now, we'll all experience all of them, but you'll get to know which ones. And when you're working with other people, I invite you to be very savvy in when you get to know that person, which one tends to jump out at you. And they'll keep falling back into that one over and over again. And as you train them and work with them, they'll start to identify it themselves and move past it. Number 3, so you have also realized exactly how pessimism has made you passive with your goal, and you've maybe even written down all the things you haven't done to make that goal a reality. And it's probably shocked you, the level to which you've been not doing things, not taking action. And number four, this is very important. At this point, you should have identified what your fear is asking you to do, like the constructive action you need to take to make that goal come about. If you do not know yet, it's very important that you email me. I've been working with all of you over email, and ask me that question, okay, because it's absolutely critical. On page six, you've also learned the three techniques for extraordinary coaching power, and you've assessed your opening awareness of them as a coach, and you're now practicing them with your coaching buddy. So at this stage, you've gone through all of these five major distinctions. Now, I'm just going to touch on a couple of things that we did last day, just to review. We looked at this idea of suppressing feelings and fears specifically. And I mentioned them earlier when we talked about beliefs, how this is when you are working with somebody or yourself and you have a belief such as I'm not good enough or I'm unlovable or I can't do something, and you're finding a bit of a stalemate and you just can't move past it. The reason why is because there's suppressed fear that is keeping that belief locked in place. So beliefs are made up of two things, thoughts and emotions. They come together to form a belief. And so you cannot solve an emotional problem using an intellectual solution. So just repeating words over and over such as, I am lovable, you know, I'm so wonderful, that's not going to work. And the reason why it's not going to work is that it is an emotional problem. In other words, there is fear that is associated with past rejections, past traumas, past abandonments that needs to be brought forth consciously, and you need to experience that. You need to actually go through the feeling. And last day I gave you sentence completions, if I were 5% more self-accepting of my fear today. You went through that and you applied it to your challenge, your goal, to get a sense of that. So, Ray, the sentence completion, if I were 5% more self-accepting, can you tell me offhand what themes came up when you did those? If you said a 5% more accepting of feeling unappreciated, you know, that feeling of unappreciated, what comes up for you when you think about it? Are you still there? Hello? Sounds like Ray's not there anymore. We'll come back to him. With the sentence completions, what it does is it trains the mind to become more open to this idea of experiencing a feeling. And what that does, of course, is allows you to release any feelings that are no longer relevant and that need to be healed. And if the problem still exists in your life and you're still struggling with it, you're still going to have feelings of rejection, for example. If you're being rejected, you're going to feel rejected. And so, but as you work with a feeling, acknowledge its existence, then you start to work on, okay, what can I do to make the relationship better so there's less rejection coming my way? And ironically, accepting the feeling allows for more positive progression in the actual problem. Good. All right, on page six, we are now in the three techniques. We're going to quickly review these. And the first one, of course, is powerful questioning. I want you to quickly take 13 seconds and I want you to write down the purpose of powerful questioning in your coaching. Please go ahead. And time. Now the next technique is empathic listening. Please write down the purpose of empathic listening, why you might use that in working with a client. Please go ahead. And the third one is educating. Please write down the purpose of educating a client, both in the area of mental toughness and learned helplessness and in the area that the client is working. Please go ahead. Good. Now what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to go back and thinking about the call that you completed this week, because you've now done a second call with your coach buddy. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to assess your awareness of each technique, and I'm going to walk you through it right now, based on the second call, not the first one. So with powerful questioning, I just want you to quickly get a sense here and answer the question on page 7. Do your questions cause clients to set goals that are both clear and effective? So you separate clear and effective. And just make a note of that. And at the bottom of 7, do your questions bring clients to a complete or incomplete diagnosis of what's been holding them back, you know, these conclusions that have been holding them back? Are they getting to those? Do you feel yes or no at this point? Now on page 8, I'd like you to make a quick note here. With empathy, imagining the client's experience from an emotional point of view, are you bringing too much empathy, too little, or just right? Are you able to put yourself in the shoes of the client from an emotional point of view? Just make a note in the middle of 8. And now on page 9, this is the education awareness exercise. Do you feel that you're educating too much, too little, or just right? And make a note there. All right, well, let's go back and briefly touch on the three techniques in terms of their purpose. Tracy, you're on the line, are you not?
Yes, ma'am.
Good. What is the purpose of powerful questioning?
So she can understand what the actual goal is.
Yep.
And get a better idea or an understanding of what the person wants to achieve. So if they don't have a clear idea of what they want to achieve, you're not going to be able to help them work together.
Excellent, yes. So that is very important, and often, you know, we discuss that people don't, and we don't, because it takes time to percolate and work through that. What else with powerful questioning?
I think it's just also, did I already say, so that we know that they have a clear vision of what they need so that they can get there?
Definitely.
That's what I had down. So understand the goal, determine if it's clear versus unclear, and then determine if it's going to be effective or ineffective. So if it's actually going to help them get to where they want to go.
Good. So,
or if they're not clear on it, then it's maybe not an effective goal.
Excellent. So when we go into powerful questioning, that is the initial line of questioning. But then what we turn our attention to is this idea of, okay, if anybody has a problem, any client has a problem, or we have a problem, there's always learned helplessness involved. In other words, we've had failures in the past. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a problem. we'd be feeling successful with it and it just wouldn't be on the radar. But when we're not, and when we have a problem, it is like a big black hole staring us right in the face, and we think about it, and we feel about it, and we talk about it incessantly. And so this is quite natural. And so there is always some failure in the past, some disappointment in the past. So the line of questioning then moves to, okay, now, what are the, what's happened? What are the frustrations that you've had in the past? And you start to explore those. And once you have a sense of the, you know, the actual events that occurred, then it moves to, well, based on the events that happened, what are the conclusions or beliefs have you drawn about yourself, about life, about the world, about this other person that you're dealing with? And you start to get a sense of the bigger picture. And then, of course, it moves to how have these conclusions made you passive? And that's where the mental toughness blueprints bring the client through that. So the powerful questioning has all of these various explorations of the learned helplessness itself. Now, what about the empathic listening? What is the point of that? Like, why can't you just talk to the client, ask the client questions? Why do you need to show empathy at all? What's your idea on that, Tracy?
Well, I'm thinking if you don't have any empathy for the client, they're really not going to open up to you. And if they're not able to open up about what their issues have been in the past, you're never going to solve them or help them solve them.
That is so well said. And, one of the things that Dean said about the first session is he said, I felt safe. And so right away, people are not going to open up to us if we don't have the unconditional 100% acceptance, this idea that we are all equal in spirit. And this comes through in so many different ways, but primarily through the voice, but people pick up on your basic energy anyway. So first of all, opening up. And there's another reason. Any ideas?
So I think so that they can trust you and trust themselves in the process, so that they can continue with the process instead of maybe falling back and saying, okay, this isn't working for me, forget it. If you run into a roadblock or a difficulty, then if you have that empathetic relationship, it's easier to move through that.
Well, and it's very well said, and the trust is exactly right. It allows for kind of like it greases things, you know, it keeps things moving forward. It's like a currency. And what I will add to that on page 8 is that when you have an accepting, empathic orientation in any conversation, and this is, good friends have done more to help people in this world than probably all the therapists put together, because when we have total empathy for another person, what we're saying is everything you feel and everything you do is okay. It's not always a goal. You know, what you do may not be constructive right now in your behavior, but it's okay. And this is actually the principle behind the 12-step programs. People get into a room and they share what they did, and no matter how horrific they think it is, self-destructive, destructive to other people, there's no judgment, there are no comments, there's no coaching of any kind. But what happens is the acceptance in the room resonates with people. And therefore, what happens to them is they actually feel more self-accepting. And when I say that, what I mean is they feel like their emotions are okay. So remember how I said that often we're suppressing how we feel about the problem? And that is keeping these negative beliefs locked in place. It's keeping progress locked in place. We can't let go. We can't move forward. When you're giving the message to the client, whatever you feel, all your fears are okay. What happens is the client feels. The client gives himself permission to feel and does feel. And people will start having these spontaneous healing experiences just from talking to you, because you're providing empathy. And I'm sure all of you have had experiences with friends and loved ones where this has happened. They've offered tremendous empathy and you had a breakthrough emotionally as a result. Now, one of the reasons why this technique is so powerful is the truth is most people get so little empathy in their daily lives that they are starving for it. Try it. Go out in your conversations this week and just show empathy. Try to get a sense of how the person is feeling. You know, paraphrase it back if you want to. Say it in your own words if you want to. You don't even need to say anything in many cases. It'll come through in how you respond to them. Most people, when you confide a worry in them, a problem in them, a concern, they try to cheer you up, they try to shut you up, or they ignore you. This makes us feel alone and angry and sad. So true listening is an art unto itself. And as you work with your coach buddy, you'll notice that your ability to listen expands dramatically. And I want you to bring that to every conversation that is emotional in nature. It's not necessary for non-emotional conversations, but every conversation that is emotional in nature, I want you to practice it and bring it, because it is profound and it will expand all our relationships. Now, the last technique is educating. And Tracy, why did you, what is the purpose? Why would you bother educating a client? Like, why do you need to teach them anything at all?
Sorry, I said so that they can become more in tune to themselves and understand sort of how they got to that situation, so that in future maybe they'll be able to prevent themselves from doing that, and they can then develop a process to solve the issues on their own. So I want to give them...
Yes, it's sort of like they kind of learn the art of self-coaching.
Yes.
Yeah. Once you teach them some basic principles to succeed in that problem... Now it's teach a man, you know, that you've taught a man to fish. If you just give advice, all you're doing is creating a dependence in them. So it's very much teach a man to fish. You're passing on these proven success principles, and then they have them for time immemorium. Good. Well, that is a nice review, and it is something that we're going to be revisiting. As we go through the program, our awareness of too little, too much, just right, getting a sense of clarity versus effectiveness, diagnosis versus non-diagnosis, and really becoming very, very skilled in knowing where we're at with these three techniques. And you can practice them every day. You don't need your coach buddy to practice them. I'll invite you to invoke them in any conversation where it appears that somebody is looking for help, assistance, or honestly just some support. And a lot of you are actually in healing professions, and a lot of you are supervising. So I think probably everybody in this training is going to have an opportunity once a day to do this. And it's absolutely, it's going to accelerate your progress dramatically. On page 9, we are now moving to the practice of commitment. And as we said, this is about honoring our desires and reconnecting to who we are and what we really want, this intrinsic motivation. The film Rudy tells a story of a football player whose mission in life is to play for Notre Dame University. But Rudy is only 5 feet tall, 100 nothing. And without a speck of athletic ability, and so it seems very unlikely that this is going to happen. But he is selected for the team. He makes a team because of his unequivocal commitment to it. And just before putting him on the team, the coach says, "You want on the team pretty bad, don't you?" And Rudy replies, "Coach, you have no idea. I'll do anything." When is the last time you've heard somebody say this? When is the last time you said it? And when you think about the goal that you set for yourself, this 30-day goal that you're working on, do you have that level of commitment to it at this point? And if not, how exciting would it be if you did? So here's where the practice of commitment shows up in the overall formula. At this stage, you've accepted and faced a problem, You know how you feel about it in much more depth than ever before. You know how pessimistic you've been and how passive you've been. But you're starting to gain a little bit of hope just through simply facing it. But that's not enough. Now we look at, how do I get motivated to act? How am I going to actually do something and solve this problem? And so this is where we are. We're taking ourselves from, hey, I've been passive. I know I've been passive. I know I've sort of given up. And it's been difficult to admit that, but I've faced my passivity. And now, how do I get the juice back? How do I get the passion back? Well, we're on page 10. What we do is we create a new goal, a completely new goal that's a learning goal. And when I say a learning goal is under our direct and immediate control. It's different than the outcome goal that you've set. You keep the outcome goal that you've set already, but you create a sub-goal, a learning goal that's going to help you get that goal that you've already set. Here's an example. If you watch the 2000 Summer Olympics, then you know that U.S. sprinter Marion Jones was forecasted to get 5 Olympic medals. And I watched the 200 meter, which was her first race, and the media was making a big deal about all the expectations. And they said, oh, Marion Jones forecasted to win 5 gold medals. And they turned to Michael Johnson, who was commentating the race, and they said, Michael, she's getting into the blocks. What is going through her mind right now? And they panned the camera to him, and you could tell he looked rather annoyed. And he said, well, I would imagine she's thinking about how to get a good start. And the reason why he looked annoyed was because the media wanted him to say something like, well, she's focusing on the hopes of America and all the expectations on her. But as an elite athlete, he knew one important thing, that the only thing to be thinking about in any performance situation, any goal situation, is what is under my direct and immediate control that's going to help me get that win. And if you're Marion and you know how to get a good start out of the blocks and you're thinking about and focusing on what to do to get a good start out of the blocks, you're going to win. So it's a learning goal. It's a goal under our direct and immediate control. And often, when I say learning goal, in addition to being under our control, it's something you don't know right now. If you knew what to do about the goal that you've set, you would have already been successfully implementing that solution, and you would already be winning. So it's a strategy, and it's a learning goal that you have no idea what it is at this moment. And you open the possibility that you don't know what to do, but you're going to set the goal to learn. And when you're coaching people, what you do is you help them understand the goal that they need to set, that's the learning goal. Now, what most people do when, you know, they're dealing with a problem is, what we do when we have learned helplessness is, again, we can't bear to think about trying again. And so we want to get away from this vulnerability, and so we disown our desires. We say, I don't want to be disappointed. So we can even become hostile. We can say, oh, I don't care about the person I want acceptance from. If we want money, we say, I don't need to be rich. If we want a promotion, we say, I don't need that. I'm sick of the politics around here. We actually reject what we want. And here are some great examples. These are actually on page 10. This is a collection of examples that clients have given me. These are verbatim. These are real people. These are things people have told me about goals. Now, the first one is the John Molo, you know, where he says, oh, every time I have a guy who tries out for the band and he doesn't get it, he stops. All he does is go on and on about how I didn't want the job. It was only a part-time job. And really what he's trying to do is cover up how devastated he is. And I just want to let him know, hey, you didn't play well enough. You just need to go and practice. That's one way, and we've all done that. The second way is, and think about your own experiences when you go through these, we force a negative outcome. So one client said to me, you know, my husband's been pulling away from me for months and our sex life has been in a big nosedive. I'm so tired of the stress. I went away on vacation. I came home and I said, I know you don't know about us, but you have to decide tonight. And then he left and I'm devastated. So we try to get in and force something. So rather than find out why he's pulling away, it's forcing it. And we do this to try to gain control of a situation. But all it does is it ensures that we lose. It ensures a losing outcome. A third one, we just silence ourselves. I've been looking after my elderly parents for months, and other than taking a shower, I don't have any breaks. I got 10 minutes a day, and I'm totally burned out. But when I talk about getting help, my mother just looks upset, so I don't talk about it again. So this is actually Ray's example earlier. He talked about, well, I just tell myself I should do all the work, and I don't actually confront people, make requests, or do that effectively. So this is very, very common. On 11, we become hostile. This is so common. Anytime we are having conflict with people that we care about and are deeply interdependent with, whether it be professionally or personally, when there's conflict, our first instinct is to try to reject them and break the relationship. My boss told me that I didn't meet his expectations, that I should get overwhelming reviews across the board, and I'm really hurt, and all I want to do is quit. That's a totally natural reaction, totally almost knee-jerk. Instead of saying, I really want to do well, and I want to get a positive performance review, and how can I do it, I'm just going to quit. Okay? And the last one is, we focus on what we call reality, and we just drop our expectations of life. I don't know, I wonder what it would be like to drive a new car instead of a used one. I've never even allowed myself to think about buying a new one. It seems so frivolous. So we don't even allow ourselves to dream because we say, oh, I need to really focus on reality. So these are all ways that we disown our desires. And remember, here is the reason we do it. We think we're going to avoid disappointment if we do this. And it kind of makes sense at first when you know, if a goal seems out of reach, oh, there's no point in wanting something I can't have. But here's the thing. This does not work. It will never work because we never relinquish our desire for success, for money, for love, or for happiness. It doesn't work. And we can tell ourselves all day long, hey, oh, I told myself I didn't want it, but the truth is we want it desperately. So whether you acknowledge that devastation or not is really not the point. The point is it's there. And all we do when we disown desires is we ensure that we lose. We ensure that we're not winning. We ensure failure. Because without that firm, unequivocal commitment to the goal, I mean, it's hard enough to reach a goal when we are committed. Some goals are very complex. They require months and in some cases years of dedication to achieve. It's hard enough when we have the commitment, let alone when we're hedging our bets and pretending maybe I do want it, maybe I don't. And when you're working with clients, one of the things you're going to get really good at is understanding how much the client has actually disowned what he or she really needs and really wants. And in relationships, it's really common to hurt other people that we love because we are angry that we're not getting the love that we want. And I use the term love. It could be approval. It could be appreciation. And we hurt them, and we lash out at them, or we distance from them and hurt them in that way. We withhold from them, and we make sure the relationship is tainted and sabotaged. So this is a continuation of disowning of the desires. So 111, here's the exercise. Here's the blueprint that you're going to use with clients, and we're going to use it on ourselves first. How have you been pretending that your goal or your challenge doesn't really matter, or that you don't care that much about solving it? And you can review the examples I just went through for ideas. So please go ahead. I want you to take a full minute on this. It's very, very important. And record your thoughts. and time. Well, Tracy, since we're on a roll, what did you write down for that one?
My goal is with regards to my weight and the way that I'm disowning it is saying that I should love myself for who I am and that I'm struggling with that and not understanding why I'm not loving myself, but then at the same time questioning why I'm letting society dictate what body shape I should be happy with.
Okay, and I'm wondering, in what ways have you told yourself that being fit doesn't matter?
I think that's my where I'm saying that, you know what, I should be happy with what I have, with who I am.
Ah, okay, sorry, I misinterpreted that. So when you tell yourself, you know, I shouldn't care about being fit and healthy and the weight that I want, I should just be happy with myself?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's very important because the reason why we get down on ourselves about something like, you know, fitness and weight is because the body itself is happier when it's in shape. So it's really not a superficial reason, like why we become disgruntled and unhappy. We may think it's all this superficial stuff, but really, when you're at your target weight or you're fighting weight, how do you feel?
I definitely felt better when I was there. I felt I was proud of myself. And
yes.
I was, you know, happy with the way that I looked. But I think more than that, yeah, I was proud of the fact that I actually was able to achieve that.
Good. And so this is so important you just use that word pride, because that pride did not come from you being socialized in a certain way or you buying into some weird beauty myth. The pride is a natural response, a natural way that your soul reacts when you're giving your body what it needs, which is oxygen, which is good stress. It is good stress and bad stress. When you exercise, you're stressing your body in a good way, because when you do that, it strengthens the body. And you know this Billy Blanks guy from the Taibo, he's got this chant on his DVD where he says, you got to be fit to fight to have a good life. Your body knows this. Your soul understands this. The pride is not because you're being superficial and telling yourself you have to have a certain weight so that people find you attractive or something. No, it's because the body needs oxygen to function. The body needs to be nourished to function. And it will automatically reward you with a feeling of pride. And when you violate these natural principles, these natural laws, and we neglect the body, what it does is it gives us a natural signal of shame. And you cannot override it. You could pep talk yourself 8 ways from Sunday all day long about how you shouldn't feel shame and you know, your pride is silly. That is your body's way of rewarding you for treating it the way it needs to be treated. And that is why, you know, everybody's in this life, you know, drank too much one evening, maybe at the age of 18 or something, and, you know, kind of abuse yourself a little. You go out with your friends on a birthday. Everybody's done this at least once in their lives. And the next day, you not only feel poorly physically, but we feel shame about it. Feel bad about having done it. And you can't pep talk yourself out of that feeling. It is what it is, and it's the body communicating. No differently than when we're afraid, it's because one of our desires or goals is in jeopardy. So it's no different at all. So for you, what you're saying is trying to tell yourself to that it's perfectly, it's, you know, you just have to ignore what society says. That's your way of saying I don't care and backing away from the goal. Good. And how do you really feel about it? Like, what do you really want?
I really want to look good and be proud of myself and be happy with who.
Yeah.
Be happy with my physical being.
You know, and I can hear it. I can hear it in your voice when you say it that way. And so reconnecting with that reconnecting with, I really want this. Like, I maybe I haven't been on a roll lately, but I really want it. That is so key, just recognizing it. And when you're working with other clients and other people, getting them to touch that and, wow, I do really want that. It makes me happy. It makes me like myself. Because they've been talking themselves out of it for a long time is a critical moment. And this blueprint, this little exercise, is what does it. Well, there are three reasons why we disown our desires. And they're very simple. And number one is obviously learned helplessness. We've tried unsuccessfully in the past to achieve the goal, and we haven't. And so this has created intense disappointment and pessimism and lack of hope. And so again, we try to back away because we don't think it's actually possible. Now, this is something we have not discussed today, but it is so critical that to understand that about 97% of the time, the reason why we're not successful with a person or a goal with a self is lack of knowledge or lack of skill. It's not always the case, but it is most of the time. I was surfing for gifts a few years ago online, and I came across books, actually, and I came across a website, www.stopyourdivorce.com. Well, I had to read it, given my line of work, and it is about, it's written by a therapist with 45 years experience who is working with couples to try to help reconcile them. And what he says is, the man says, hey, my wife comes home every night and all she says is, I want a divorce. And the therapist said, okay, I'm going to tell you to do three things. The next time she comes home and she says that, I want you to tell her the three things and then stop talking. Well, the next day, the client phones in and says, I couldn't wait till next week to see you. My wife came home. She said, I don't love you anymore, and I want a divorce. And I told her the three things, and she got up and walked around the house and came back and said, you know, I think this marriage can work, and I want it to work. Well, here are the three things that he said. When she said, I don't love you anymore, I want a divorce, he said, I agree. It's just not working. Now, this is unusual, because when one person says that he wants or she wants a divorce, almost invariably, the other person will argue. No, we're really good together. Please don't give up on us. We're so compatible. Look at everything that we've done in our lifetimes together. So it's the opposite of what most people do, but part of the reason it works is it provides agreement and empathy. Well, he's never agreed with me for 25 years. He's argued with me. And whenever you have a conflict, a disagreement of some kind, what most people do is they exaggerate the conflict and they take the opposite approach. They take the opposite point of view. And when that happens, we dig in. We become more entrenched in our opinion. And when people go with our position, we tend to relax it a bit. Now, the second thing he said to her was, I would like to stay married to you. I would prefer it, but I can see that you're very, very unhappy. Now, bear in mind, he's not pretending that he wants a divorce. He's being honest, so he's being authentic. And when he says, I prefer you, what he's doing is he's putting the responsibility for the divorce on her shoulders. And there's a lot of good in most marriages, and nobody wants to be the bad guy, and nobody wants to be the person to end it for that reason. So all of a sudden, he's transferred the weight of this very, very monumental decision onto her. This is a lot of responsibility. And the third thing he said is, I'll get an apartment next week. Now, the reason why that works is it creates an impression of confidence. You're cute. I would prefer you. But I'll be okay. You know, it's a blow. But I'll be okay. And confidence is universally attractive, and fear is universally unattractive. And when she hears something like this, automatically it's the opposite of pressure. Pressure is, you must love me. You must stay married to me. People don't like pressure. People react away from pressure. with three little sentences, all of a sudden, he's got a position now where she might be willing to talk about why she wants a divorce. There's a lot of work yet to be done. But now, she just might share some of the reasons. And the reason I told you this story is because I said that 97% of the time, when we're not winning with a problem or a person, it's because we are lacking skill, communication skills in most cases, or knowledge. In this situation, this person who contacted the therapist didn't know what to say to his wife. No idea. That's a lack of knowledge. It's a lack of skill. That was the main problem. And often we think we know what we're doing, but if we have a problem, we need to take the default position that we don't. Well, the second reason is lack of self-assertiveness. This is people-pleasing. So if your goal requires that you assert yourself with others, you may put the goal on the back burner rather than risk conflict. So what we know is that sometimes the reason we don't honor our desires is other people have a different agenda for us. They've got our time planned out. They've got things they want us to do. And sometimes we just do them. Ray on the call earlier said, well, I'm getting a lot of pressure just to buck up and do all this work. And so sometimes we disown our desires because there's intense pressure. And the truth is people have an agenda for your life and your time. And they will impress it upon you. And if you haven't really thought through who you are and what you want and what is important to you, and you're willing to assert yourself and you're willing to say, I matter, what I want matters. In other words, I want to go win-win here, not lose-win and give in all the time. Then it's going to be very, very challenging to really, really honor our desires. And the third reason why we disown our desires is self-alienation. And this is just a way of saying that we choose goals that don't reflect our values. In other words, we choose goals because maybe society or other people tell us they're a good idea, or we're good at something so we think we should want to do it, but it really doesn't jazz us up, get us pumped at all. It doesn't fill us with excitement, but we think, you know, we've been told it's a good idea. There was a study done of the top musicians in the world, the creme de la creme, so to speak, and the study asked the question, why do some people excel in music over others? And they talked about demographics, you know, where do they all come from? They looked at, do they come from a musical family? Geographically, where do they live? Is there an IQ differential? They looked at all these factors, and they found only one was a common denominator among all these top musicians, the top 1% of the top 1%, and it was this. They had all practiced their instruments for a minimum of 10 to 15 hours a week, a minimum of 10 to 15 years. And that was the only thing they all had in common. And it was inviolate. You know, nobody had practiced for 5 years. Nobody had practiced for 5 hours for 25 years. No, they had all practiced those minimums. And so, you know, there's a great quote from one of the musicians who says, you know, I don't do things that I don't like to do, but I love to practice. And I was always practicing in school, and I was missing class, and I wore my lips down to a frazzle practicing before big concerts because I only want to do things that I love to do. And what was most important to me was my relationship to music. And often we lose sight of these things. We lose sight of what we really care about, and we're off doing a heck of a lot of things that we don't want to do, not doing things that we do want to do. So it's really important when you're motivating yourself to grasp that telling yourself to do something because it's, quote, a good idea doesn't go very far and doesn't last very long. We're on 12 now. For the goal, the 30-day goal to inspire you and make you into a person of action, there are three criteria based on what I've just taught. Number one, it has to be a learning goal. Your goal must give rise to a fresh, new strategy. You need to do things differently, in some cases, very differently. You're not going to go back and do the same things that you were doing before. That is a given. You're going to learn a new strategy. Number two, it's got to be win-win in nature. So rather than lose-win where you're giving in and accommodating, you need to be willing to go win-win. And the reason why I say win-win is if you have a tendency to be lose-win, as in accommodate to provide rapport, then you're not going to turn around and go win-lose and try to assert yourself at the other person's expense. This is totally not going to be not only inappropriate, but it's not going to be possible for you. You're not going to be able to do that. That will just be so opposite of your nature, but you probably can get behind win-win. And the third is it's got to reflect your values. What do you stand for? What do you live for? What would you die for? What are your core values, desires that need to be expressed? The goal must reflect them. And here's the basic litmus test. If you look at your goal and you get excited just looking at it, like it pumps you up, then it's a real goal. And if it doesn't, it's just a sentence on a piece of paper and it's not a goal. And when you're working with other people, you'll know if they've hit on a real goal because their voice will convey excitement. And you'll know when it's just a wannabe goal because they will not be pumped about it. Not at all. It'll just be going through the motions. Mental toughness blueprint. I want you to write down for me right now, is the goal that you've set for this 30-day window, is your goal triggering this kind of commitment in you? In other words, is it meeting these three criteria? If not, how would you change it to make it motivating? That's all. Just take about 30 seconds. Is it triggering this kind of commitment? And if not, what's missing in these three criteria? Please go ahead. So Tracy, you're working on fitness, yes? That's a huge goal right now?
Yeah.
Okay. So what did you come up with there? Like of those three things?
Of those three, I would say number one, no, I'm not doing that because I haven't learned any new strategies. I'm still trying to do the same old. And I don't believe right now for me it's not a win-win situation because it's something that I'm trying to force myself to do. Like I'm thinking I need to be working out with weights and I need to be walking on the treadmill or running on the treadmill. And so those, I mean, I don't mind them, but it's not something that I really enjoy. And I think it does reflect my values because I do believe in being healthy and being happy. And I've changed my thoughts about myself recently with how my emotional feelings are, so now I want to change my physical feelings. So I think what I might look at trying to do is working with a training coach or a personal trainer. I've never done that before. And to find something that I think what I really want to do, what's really speaking to me, is to find something that I can play at, if that makes sense, and get fit at the same time. So something that is allowing my inner child to have some fun and allowing me to have some fun, but also getting the goal of the exercise out of it.
Yes, and so why did you, it's interesting that you use the word fun. Why did you pick that word?
Because when I think about how I was younger in my athletic days, I enjoyed doing my sports because because it was fun, and I didn't have a problem working hard in my sports because it was fun and I enjoyed it.
Good. And so to me, that sounds like a core value.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the other thing about it is that it's intrinsically motivating.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you would do it for its own sake. You do it without getting paid. You do it just to do it.
Yeah, and it
yeah.
doesn't seem like work either, whereas if I have to run, get on a treadmill, that to me seems like work.
Right, right, absolutely. And so,
yeah.
you know, when you look at, if you contrast those two things, like, honestly, do people like to work? Like, think about it. Do
yeah.
human beings like to work?
No, not usually.
No. No, not at all. In fact, they'd rather watch TV than work, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when you think about that, TV is always going to win out. I'm not saying you're watching TV. I'm saying
yeah.
when you just think about human nature, we love our leisure.
Yeah.
People love leisure time. It's our nature. So what you basically just said to me was, I don't want to fight my nature anymore as a human being. And yes, there's a very small percentage of the population who, of those 16 human desires, the desire for muscle activity is actually one of the 16. And they're buffer than buff. And they're out there every day at 5 a.m. But they are a vast minority. And power to them. But most of us prefer leisure to work. Anything that we experience as work. And what you're telling me is lifting weights is work. Yeah, so I'm not saying you should never do it. I'm saying you'll probably do it when you're in the mood to work.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you probably do it when you're in that mood.
Yep,
yeah.
Right.
Great. So I love the core value of fun. It really seems to be based on your previous experience in life and very much you.
Yeah.
Good. You might be interested to know that they did a survey, Sport Canada did a survey of kids about why they play sports, and they asked them for their top reasons about why they both joined and why they keep playing. And I would have thought, oh, you know, friends and fun. Fun and friends were on the list, but the number one was learning new skills. That shocked me. These are little kids answering this survey, like 9-year-olds.
Yep.
And that suggested to me that the core desire or core value of mastery is very strong in kids who play sports. How does that fit with you?
I would say it fits really, really good with me. I tend to try to be a perfectionist. So, yes, I want to master what I'm doing.
Good. So for you, mastery also plays into if you're playing a game and you're excelling at the skills, that's going to be an added bonus.
Yeah.
Good. So what you've hit on today is, hey, I need an activity that combines fun, muscle activity, and, you know, because I value fitness and I value taking care of myself and mastery. And I would not rest until you find those three things in one activity. And the other thing that is a potential motivator, because when you told me that you're trying to get yourself to lift weights, have you been trying to do that at home?
Yeah.
Yeah. So is there any accountability if you don't show up?
No.
I don't know about you, but for me, that's definitely a factor. As in, you know, I play team sports, and on a Sunday night when I've got a game at 9 p.m. or 10 p.m., and I'm not feeling overly excited about getting off the couch, I don't want a hate mail in my inbox the next day about why didn't I come. And I'm joking about the term hate, but I don't want to let the team down. And so it's just another added way of, as you said, maybe I'll get a trainer. Like maybe I'll get an accountability I'll get something where people know if I don't show. You know, it seems obvious, and yet we overlook it.
Well, I think with me, I've always thought, you know, I'm trained in it because, like I said, I was an athlete, and I've also got a kinesiology degree, so I'm thinking, okay, why can't I do this on my own? I should be able to do it on my own.
Yeah, I think that's a false expectation that is unrealistic. Like I said, there's a very small minority of the population that fall into that category, but the truth is most of those people are training for something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've got a sport they're training for or a competition that they're training for. And so they do have that extra motivator as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, when you were competing and playing sports, did you not think about when you were, you know, working out, were you not thinking about your next game and thinking about being fit for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all works together, and these things seem obvious, but they're not obvious because we violate them all the time. We expect ourselves to get pumped about something when we haven't put in the parameters to be pumped about them. Now, we'll move on to the bottom of 12. This is another blueprint that is very powerful. I want you to write down a time when you set a daunting goal in your life, something that was pretty big, and you achieved it. So pick a goal that you've already achieved in the past. And I want you just to write briefly a brief paragraph here about how your burning desire to achieve your goal helped you persevere until you eventually succeeded. So, you know, maybe there were fears, maybe there were people that were obstacles, maybe it was just hard. I just want you to describe how your desire helped you get through those tough moments. So please go ahead. I'm going to give you a minute to finish that exercise. And time. So Tracy, what did you come up with there?
Well, I did a program back in, I think it was 2000, and it was a 12-week program in which involved exercise and eating, and I did lose 30 pounds at that time. And I think my biggest motivator was because my partner at the time told me that he didn't believe that I could do it. So I wanted to prove to him that I could.
Negative motivation can really work.
Yeah.
You know?
So, and it was a 12-week program, so I thought, you know what, I can do this for 12 weeks. I can make it happen.
Good.
And, of course, what happened afterwards was, and the program involved buying ready-made shakes and whatever else, and I didn't want to have to spend the money all the time to do that. And then once I was off the program, I ended up gaining that all back and then an additional few pounds as well.
Was this exercise or was it not exercise, this program?
It was an exercise. It was exercise and eating together.
Okay, it was both. And was it a program that you self-administered or were there other people involved?
No, I self-administered it, but it was a program that I read in a book.
Okay, was it like a Body for Life type thing?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So it was a set out and it was limited, right? And it was very directive, like it told you exactly what to do.
Yeah.
Was that helpful to you?
Yeah, it was, because I think it kept me on track.
Yeah.
So I was able to keep track or keep record of what I had done.
Yes. So I would say that is something, you know, that worked for you, and that is something that you want to revisit, which is, you know, being able to keep track of it and have this extrinsic record. Works for you. Not having it does not work. That is not going to work. And so what we're doing here is we're putting in all the building blocks, all the elements, and you're going to need them all.
Mm-hmm.
And not because it's you, but because stack the deck in your favor.
Yeah.
Right? It costs you nothing to make something structured in this way, to write things down. But if there are people involved, you know, that you're accountable to, even better. And you know what? I mean, this is just a gut feeling just from talking to you tonight, but I think you're a fairly competitive person. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes.
Yeah. I would use that. I would milk that all day long. And working out in your basement with your weights, is that going to bring out your competitive side?
No.
No. It's not going to touch it. It's not going to touch your heart. You're one of these people, it's like, yeah, I can do it. And I can do it probably better than you. And that's a good thing. Because it gets you fired up. It gets you going. You need to see that. You need to see your results and what you've accomplished reflected in a mirror with other people. And I think his comment that you couldn't do it fired up that competitive juice in you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's only one comment that can't take you for the rest of your life. So your competitiveness is going to, that alone, Tracy, that alone would make you work harder than you could ever possibly want to work in a given workout session. You would go the extra mile every single time. Just not to lose, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the truth is there are people who are not competitive. That is not part of their makeup. They cannot tap into that. It's not really who they are. So this is a wonderful quality, and you definitely want to use it.
Okay.
So again, what you set up for yourself, it's going to have to be something where you can, you know, see your results compared to other people. You know, and that's why sports are so great. It's very obvious how you're doing. Team is better because it's team versus team, right? But still, even if it's an individual thing, you've got to be able to compare your efforts. So when you're working with these blueprints and using them, notice that when you talk to a client about, hey, do they have these three elements? Does your goal have these three elements? The client will know. He or she will know, yeah, it's got these elements, it doesn't have these elements, and they'll be very self-aware about them. And going back to a past success story will give you clues to what motivated this person in the past. And they'll relate to that experience. It'll give them confidence because they can say, oh, I did it, and I really kicked butt. And so it brings them back to a time when they were super motivated, and they can go back and get a sense of what that was like. Moving to 13, we're very much in the home stretch here. Actually, this is going to be our last exercise for the evening. And this last blueprint is, I want you to set a learning goal for your challenge/goal, the 30-day goal. Remember I said that the learning goal was the goal inside the goal? It was the goal that's underneath your control because you're going to learn. And what I've put on page 13 is a fairly comprehensive list of things that we can learn. Now, it's not completely comprehensive. It won't cover every challenge in this lifetime, but it'll cover most of them. It'll cover most of them. So I want you to take, again, another 30 seconds, scan the list, try to lock on to the goal that is most on point to your personal challenge, and put it in the bottom of 13. If nothing matches, that's okay. You can invent your own. Very likely, though, something will. So please go ahead. and time. Tracy, what did you write down on 13?
Well, it's not related to the goal that we've been talking about. What I said was to learn how to move people to action, respond to my requests, and that is dealing with the students that I teach.
Yes, okay. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to table that for, because after this week we're moving to relationship mastery, and that is a skill that we're going to focus on quite a bit, which is getting people to do what they need to do and what we need them to do and respond to our requests. So it's a great one. So thank you for bringing that up. I just want to touch base here. In terms of when you think about your commitment to exercising, what have you come up with in your coaching calls with your buddy about anything that's holding you back, any learned helplessness, any fears that you're having? Has something come to light?
Well, we actually had trouble with I had trouble trying to determine what my fear was telling me to do. That's what I was struggling with, that whole society thing and the belief that, you know, society is telling me that this is how I should be looking, because I don't feel unhealthy. I am healthy, but it's just my physical appearance that I'm not happy with. So we struggled with that. I'm still not honestly quite sure what my fear is trying to tell me to do.
Yeah, well, I'm going to mention something, and you can try it on and see if it fits. I would say, you know, in terms of whatever pessimism you have or, you know, giving up about it, is it's asking you to pull together all the elements that we've discussed tonight and find the right fit for you. Because your pessimism is reflecting that you've been putting together strategies that just simply are not workable for you.
Yeah.
Not motivating.
That makes sense. It's not true to me. It's not fun. I'm not having fun, and I need
to
be having some fun.
No, you don't even look forward to it. So you're not going to do it. And just admitting that should release you a bit here.
Okay.
And just face that fact. Acknowledge it. It's totally okay. It's actually quite normal. And understand that your pessimism, which is, oh, why even bother? I'm not going to ever get into a disciplined routine, is asking you to say, well, who really am I? What kind of person, what do I really value and care about when I'm exercising? Well, I care about fun. Well, I'm competitive, right? I want other people to see what I'm doing. I need structure. I need to see my results on paper as well. You know, all these things pulling it together. Now, the one thing that we didn't touch on that we would have touched on in the practice of self-acceptance, because we're only doing this piecemeal, like I'm only working with you on this one practice, so we jumped in the middle, so to speak, is one of the things that, we're not going to go through it tonight because we're at the ending of this call, but one of the things to think about is, of course, last day I mentioned that we all get into these cycles of mild depression and demotivation when life hands us adversity and setbacks. And so when we are on any kind of ongoing workout program or sport commitment, when we get derailed, when we get sort of, we go off the wagon, it's because we hit one of these snags and we're not feeling very pumped. You know, the edge of our energy is off. And so when you're going to go through and you're going to find the right activity for you and you're going to set that up. But as you go through things, understand that when we go through these cycles, the best way to keep up that momentum is to diagnose that problem, diagnose the learned helplessness and the mild depression that's coming up and fixing it, because that is a core skill that keeps us in good habits. Good habits come from that core skill. Because you can override, you know, sort of that demotivated feeling for a couple of days. But honestly, by day three, it's like resisting gravity. So that skill that we're learning in this course of, hey, understanding when I feel depressed, oh, I've given up on something really important, I'm going to figure out what that is and I'm going to start winning, that will keep the good habits going. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So I just wanted to mention that piece because we can't really address this issue without explicitly mentioning it. So you can think about that. And I know, as I mentioned, at least half of the people in this training program are addressing this goal too, and Lord knows probably everybody has it to a certain extent, so it's worth mentioning. All right, we are going to defer the rest of the materials to next day because we're out of time for tonight, and we've accomplished a lot. Page 16 is the one we're on. These are your week 3 assignments. Listen to tonight's audio. Focus on your awareness of the practice of commitment, raising it using the blueprints, and the 3 techniques for extraordinary coaching power. You're going to do those awareness exercises. I want you to make notes. When I say make notes on the conversation that I had with Tracy, because except for last week, every single session that we have together, I'm going to coach somebody. And the purpose of that is not only to help that person, but I'm demoing coaching here. And when you're listening to it in the call, you may not be realizing what's happening in the demo unless you step back and actually write down what I'm doing. And I want you to be learning these techniques from listening as you go through it, okay? So make the, you know, what am I doing on the calls? What questions am I asking? You're going to have your own style, not mine, but it's very important that you grasp all the techniques and start implementing them. Number 3, meet with your coaching buddy again this week and use the blueprints for the practice of commitment. Again, don't worry about covering the same ground. You can try a new goal if the other one is already met or it's old news. We are not going to switch coaching buddies this week. We will worry about that next week. So very simple. You're just going to really go over the ground for tonight as we've covered a lot of new material. Make sure you send me any of your questions over the course of the next week, and we will go from there. Thank you very much for attending tonight's session, and I look forward to next week. Have a great night.